This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Abdul Rahman, the Afghan Christian, made it out of Afghanistan alive by the skin of his teeth this week. The Afghan Muslim convert to Christianity was temporarily released as insane and flown secretly to Italy, while many Afghans clamored for his execution for leaving Islam. The whole world was watching. American soldiers risking their necks for Afghanistan, American citizens asking what we've fought for here, and in that wondering crowd, Afghan-American memoirist Masuda Sultan, straddling two cultures, her arranged marriage in New York, U.S.-killed cousins in Kandahar, and now this. Up next on Point, Afghan-American Masuda Sultan, the Great Divide, and the case of the Afghan Christian. And later in this hour, we'll have the latest on freed American journalist Jill Carroll. We turn first today to Kabul and Kim Barker, correspondent for the Chicago Tribune in Afghanistan. She's been covering the story of Abdul Rahman, the Christian convert who faced execution for his religious conversion. Kim Barker, thanks for being with us. What's the latest?
Thanks for having me, Tom. Well, the latest, as everybody probably knows by now, is that Abdul Rahman has been granted asylum in Italy and actually landed there last night. So he has left the country. The case against him has not been dismissed. It's been put on hold pending mental evaluation of Mr. Rahman. But most likely he'll never return, so therefore the case will never come back to haunt him. But the court has reserved the right to refile the charges against him if he does return and if they do decide that he is indeed sane.
Kim, this story has really got a lot of attention in America and around the world. Remind us of the basics here of who Abdul Rahman was and how he ended up facing potential death because of his Christianity.
Abdul Rahman is a 40-year-old man. He's an Afghan man from the Panjshir Valley. About 16 years ago, while working in Pakistan in Peshawar, he was working for a Christian aid agency and converted to Islam while he was there. At some point about that time, he was put into an arranged marriage by his family from Afghanistan, had two daughters, promptly divorced his wife, and left Afghanistan and Pakistan, moving instead to Europe, primarily Germany and Belgium. About 3 years ago, he came back to Afghanistan and lived with his family at that point, was sort of appeared to be struggling from everybody I've talked to, was not working any jobs, was not doing much of anything, was in trouble with his family. The one thing that he was very firm about, however, was that he was a Christian, he had converted, and that this was very important to him, and it was definitely a cause of friction with him and his family. This case came to a head this year in February when his family filed complaints against him with the local police, chiefly because they felt that he was abusive and they felt that he was not working. He was just complaining all the time and, you know, hitting his father, hitting his daughters, and also that he was immoral. And primarily he was immoral because of his conversion to Christianity. He, in return, went to the police station and filed his own complaint saying that he was being persecuted because he was a Christian. After this, he was taken downtown and ended up facing charges of converting from Christianity or from Islam to Christianity. And that's when the whole case really took off, because this charge is not covered under Afghanistan's penal code. Instead, it's covered under Islamic law, because there's nothing that's mentioned about conversion or apostasy in Afghanistan's penal code.
So at that point, everybody's attention was turned here. You went into the streets of Kabul, and what did you find, Kim Barker? Is this just a few Islamic fundamentalists who wanted him to die for this conversion? Or the way I'm reading you, it sounds like a very widely held sentiment.
It's pretty widely held from the people I talked to. What I was surprised about was people who, you know, I felt were sort of modern young Afghans. They wear jeans. They buy button-up shirts at the local sort of mall here, if you could call it that. And they're friends of mine. They shake my hand. They serve me breakfast in the morning. They also thought that he should be hung. However, they were saying that not because they're mean people or not because they're evil people or not because they hate Christians. They're saying that because that's what they're hearing from the very respected clerics here. And that's the understanding that the clerics here are putting out of Islam and of the Quran, although there's plenty of people that disagree with that interpretation. But yeah, most of the people I talked to did think he should be killed.
So how did he get out of this? There was tremendous pressure brought to bear, we know, from the United States government and others on Afghan President Hamid Karzai. How was the needle threaded here?
Well, it should be remembered that Hamid Karzai has signed an execution order on only one person since taking over. I never thought that Hamid Karzai would ever sign this man's death warrant. The interesting thing is that the case existed and that he could face the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
He got out of it largely through international pressure, in my opinion, but the judiciary completely disagrees with that. They say it's because he was mentally ill, and they suddenly discovered he was mentally ill. I can't speak to whether he is indeed mentally ill or not, but it is something that has threaded its way through the case, and it's something that, you know, his family members have said he was mentally ill, not because he converted, but because of the way he acted and the way he treated them. But, you know, it's not for me to say.
And
it became an easy excuse. Yeah?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask how he actually got out of the country. He was released because of this issue of alleged mental illness or contended mental illness. Suddenly, he's somewhere in Italy, Rome. I'm not sure. How?
It's a very good question. He was released on Monday night under the cover of darkness. He was, according to people who talked to me, sources, he was taken away by UN officials, but the UN will not confirm that. He was hidden out for 24 hours while they figured out what to do with him. 24 hours or 48 hours, 48 mm-hmm. hours, actually, while they figured out what to do with him. And then he was flown off to Italy when nobody really had any idea that he was being taken out of the country or anything. In fact, this happened just after Afghanistan's parliament announced that it was sending a letter to the Interior Ministry saying that this man should not be allowed to leave the country under any circumstance.
How rare
is... At that point, you know, the wheels were in motion.
How rare is it to be a Christian in Afghanistan? Is there a significant population of Afghan Christians or not?
It's hard to say. It's nothing that any census would cover here. There are visible Sikhs, visible Hindus here, but they are very much in the minority. Christian converts tend to keep pretty hidden here. The Sikhs and the Hindus have always been Sikh. They've always been Hindus, so they don't have to worry about, you know, being converted and being accused of turning their backs on Allah or on Islam. But the converts, according to a person I talked to in the United States, an Afghan Christian who was granted asylum in America and is sort of the unofficial, I would say, headquarters for Afghan Christians, he says he's personally in touch with more than 6,000 Afghan Christians who have converted. But it's not like they have a church. It's not like they're out in public waving Bibles around. They meet in houses. They meet together. They study the Bible on their own. It's something that people do not talk about here if they're Christian. They're scared to talk about it. They would never go forth and proselytize and try to convert other people. Because it is something, look what happened to Mr. Rockland. It's very clear what could happen in that case.
And Kim, what do you make of the culture gap that's been illuminated here? I mean, you're quoting a construction worker, 32 years old, he should be stoned to death, he says. A baker, 40 years old, he should be hanged in a square. Are Afghans aware of how much of the world, certainly the United States, looks upon this?
You know, they certainly became aware, and to think of Afghanistan as being in some sort of bubble where they don't get international news at this point is incorrect. I mean, people pay attention to the news here. They listen to the radio here. But the thing with Afghanistan is historically, any time you've got an international community, whether it's the Brits, whether it's the Soviets, whether it's the Americans, coming in here and saying this is the way you should do things, Afghans tend to push back. They don't like being told what to do, and they don't like being told how they should think or how they should run the country. So I think that even some of people saying, well, this is what should happen to them, was in reaction to feeling this pressure from the West, telling them that this is what you should do. You're being a bad democracy. You're being bad Muslims. You're not giving us credit for all we have done for you. And I think a lot of Afghans felt very resentful towards that.
And meanwhile, a lot of American soldiers right there in that country having fought to push the Taliban out. Kim Barker, thank you very much for being with us from Kabul.
Sure, thank you, Tom.
Kim Barker is a correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. We're talking this hour with Afghan-American memoirist Masouda Sultan about Afghanistan and the country and the culture America's fighting for. Masouda Sultan joins me from New York. Her new memoir is My War at Home. Masouda Sultan, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
We've just got a minute before the break, but give us your top-of-mind reaction to the story that's turned everyone's heads in this last week of the Afghan Christian convert and the way your home country, your country of birth, responded to his Christianity. Were you shocked or not?
I can't say that I was shocked. You know, there have been many cases in Afghanistan of women being accused of very simple crimes, as they call it, such as traveling without a male relative or not fulfilling household duties. And we've seen the judicial system is completely in shambles. So it's not a surprise that that this case has occurred. I think what it highlights, though, is that unfortunately in Afghanistan still, it takes such an appalling situation to bring the international media, the world's attention back to Afghanistan. My problem with this is, you know, we can't breathe just because Abdulrahman has found a way out. We have to realize that this highlights the extreme problem of judicial reform that's not happening within the country. And every day there are thousands of similar cases of ordinary men and women being accused of doing things that we in this country would never consider a crime. So I think it speaks to the larger issue.
Masudah Sultana, I wish you'd to take us further in here. Your perspective is such a unique one, and it seems so astonishing that death was suddenly on the table for this man last week. But we want to understand it in its subtlety. You're saying America needs to push more for the reform of the judicial system in Afghanistan, but of course it's that system is straddling the constitution and traditional Islamic law. Is this something America can really resolve?
America can't resolve it because we can't make decisions for Afghanistan. But what America can do is to support, as we have already committed to, support the reconstruction of the country. And that includes reforming the judicial system and funding very ordinary things like the translation of laws throughout the world. To my understanding, the Afghans on the ground, lawyers, are struggling just to pay for the translation from English and other languages to Dari and Pashto, the translation of very simple documents so that they can have the tools they need to argue for democracy, for freedom, and for all the rights that we know that they want and need. So when it comes to the role of the United States in judicial reform in Afghanistan, I think there's a huge opportunity there. We don't have to push our values on them. They, you know, I think these values are universal, and to my understanding, they're supported by Islam. And so we do have a role in that. The problem is when we start to dictate to others how it should be done, and that's what I think the previous person you interviewed was getting at. Afghans do not like to be told what to do. We have our own traditions, there's, of course, a huge lack of education about Islam and Sharia law, and there are some tensions. The Constitution leaves a lot open and leaves a lot of room for people to argue what it is they believe. But, you know, that's the beauty of organic sort of discussion and debate and democracy in a free country. Those discussions need to be going on. Those debates need to be happening. But we need to be supporting them from the outside and allowing people to have the resources to have those debates.
So get the law translated, get it distributed. But the Islamic law that's being cited here is many centuries old, the Sharia law reference here. How do you see the country of your birth? Is it, you know, in the last week, it's looked to some like some kind of medieval nightmare underway. Is it, in fact, teetering towards something that we would recognize as a more modern democracy, or is it itself spanning centuries here?
Afghanistan is still a very conservative country, extremely conservative. The tribal culture still rules in large part. The Chief Justice Shinwari himself, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court himself, is not educated in secular law, as I understand it. So there, the religious leaders have led, and elders have interpreted religion for a very long time, particularly during the war, where religion was sort of the organizing force and what pushed people towards fighting the Soviets. And that was the identity that people took on. So it's going to take a lot of time and a lot of work to bring Afghanistan back into the modern age. But, you know, there are other Muslim countries that we can look at that are resolving these debates in a much better way. Afghanistan has a lot of work to do, and it's still, again, a very conservative country.
You're in the United States speaking to us from New York today. In the last week, you must have talked with plenty of Americans about this. How do you think Americans are receiving the news that's come out in this individual case? I mean, do they seem to you to have an accurate sense of what's going on? What do you make of the American response, and what does it say about the long-term relationship between these two countries, these two cultures?
Well, I think what this case illustrates, to Americans at least, is that all is not right in Afghanistan. I think partially because of what's happening in Iraq, everyone wants to believe that Afghanistan is such a great success story. Of course, relative to Iraq, it seems much better. But I think Americans now realize that Afghanistan is complex, that it is very conservative, and that, you know, part of it, I think, is also that Americans are probably appalled that a country that they think that they've been contributing to realizing certain values perhaps doesn't yet. But to that, I would say that I have a lot of hope. I believe in my heart that the relatives that I met in Afghanistan and that I continue to be in touch with do not want Abdulrahman to be stoned or to be killed. There are certainly people who want that. But, you know, in Afghanistan, there's so much pressure, public pressure. There's a very different space, the public and the private space. Publicly, people will say, you know, that he should be stoned. But privately, they may feel very differently. And it's not really an environment yet right now where you can speak your mind, where you can, you know, engage in a meaningful discussion about Islam, you know, openly, because there, again, there is this pressure. The conservatives are now seeing this as an opportunity to prove their identity. And because we are, our reconstruction efforts, unfortunately, have many problems. The fact that international consultants get paid very much. Afghans, ordinary Afghans, are watching people fly in and out of their country, you know, like doctors checking their pulse, then flying back out, asking them questions, then coming back. They see all this happening. And without significant progress in their lives, they're not going to believe that America is committed to them. And the religious conservatives are saying, look, America, look at what America is trying to do. They're scantily clad actresses are on our televisions. They want people to convert to Christianity, and they purport to support education and healthcare and ordinary Afghans. But how much of that do you have? And so this becomes really, really difficult to defend.
Mm. Afghan-American memoirist Masuda Sultan is with us from New York. Her new memoir is My War at Home. 27-year-old Afghan-American, a very unusual perspective on everything we're seeing unfolding. Let's turn to a listener. Suad is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Suad, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. What do you think?
Okay, well, I have a comment. First of all, as a Muslim of Arabic descent and an American, I think that Mr. Mahmoud Abdulrahman is free to worship whatever he wants. And even in the Quran, it says that everybody is free to worship whatever they want. We're not God. We're not the judge.
Mm-hmm.
That's on the one hand. On the other hand, we should be, as Americans, very, very careful how we handle this and how we talk about this on TV or in radio, because we don't want to give the impression to others that this is the way it has to be done, and this is how we see democracy, because even we live here our own ways, we would never accept somebody coming from another religion or another culture telling us what you were doing is wrong, this is the way it should be done. So this is my comment. And
So he should live, but Americans need to be careful about how they say so. But Suad, I mean, the country, the United States, has invested a lot in Afghanistan. It surely isn't surprising to you to see Americans saying, what the heck is going on with that?
Well, I'm not surprised. But at the same time, what it tells me is there's a little bit, for lack of a better word, that a lot of people don't know exactly what that culture is about and what how people think. So if they know, if they're a little bit more aware of those cultures, they are going to wonder why are these people treating these people, but they're just going to wonder and try to solve the problem, but not say, excuse me, you know, what the heck are you doing?
Sawad, thanks for your call. Masuda, what is it fair for American expectations to be here, for America, what's fair for America to ask here of Afghanistan on an issue like this? Masuda?
What's fair for America to ask Afghanistan? I think there are lots of questions Afghanistan probably wants to ask America. I kind of see it that way as well. I think, you know, it's fair for us to be appalled. I do sympathize with the American reaction, and you know, it shakes us to our core to know that, you know, the freedoms that we uphold, that we think that we're bringing to other countries, are not valued. But we need to be asking lots of questions. I think it's fair for America to ask all kinds of questions. And it's only when we do start to ask those very difficult questions that we'll start to understand what's really going on there. I think the problem is that we haven't been asking those questions. So if you ask me what's fair for Americans to ask, I say there's no question that's not fair to ask.
So let's get it on the table. Your story is a remarkable one in itself. I wish you'd share some of it with us. You were born in Kandahar, lived in Afghanistan until you were about 5. Tell us the story of your family, Masuda Sultan, and your young life in America as an Afghan American. What was that like?
It's been interesting. I have come from a very conservative family, and we came from a very conservative place. Kandahar was the it's no coincidence that Kandahar was a former stronghold of the Taliban. It's a very conservative city. It's the second largest city in Afghanistan. And we left this life that, you know, in my parents' memory was incredibly beautiful and wonderful, where my father would teach at a girls' school during the day and come home, and we would have a big feast lunchtime and, according to them, fall asleep right there in the room after we had eaten.
What a life. Why did they leave?
Well, the Soviets invaded in 1979, and by the time that we left the city, two-thirds of the entire city had either been killed or had escaped.
That's and a pretty good reason to go.
Mm-hmm. It's a pretty good reason to flee, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And did your parents try to keep Afghan culture, Afghan moral strictures alive in your home in New York, in Flushing?
Of course. I think part of it was that they never wanted to leave Afghanistan, you know, unlike some of the immigrants who came here by choice for sort of economic opportunity, et cetera. They had planned to live in Afghanistan their whole lives, just like my, you know, grandparents and great-grandparents. And so for them, I think it was really important, as well as for our community, to maintain as much of that identity as possible, especially because they thought for a long time that they would go back to Afghanistan once there was freedom, and that, you know, we grew up with that idea. And also to just maintain a sense of community. We, for example, during Eid is a very big holiday for Muslims. There's two different Eids, one after Ramadan and one related to the Islamic pilgrimage to Mecca. Mm-hmm. But my favorite holiday is actually Thanksgiving. But we have begun to celebrate Thanksgiving more and more as a big holiday, because that's when people are off work, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, so we've started to adapt some of our traditions. But Eid is still a very big one. After the month of fasting, Ramadan, we celebrate for 3 days, and all of our family comes together. And it really is like Thanksgiving. I mean, we cook up a huge feast. Children get money from their elders, which is, you know, for them, it's like Christmas and Thanksgiving rolled up into one. And it's a time of togetherness.
So good times in America, a kind of a Thanksgiving feeling, but your parents kept a lot of tradition alive. You've grown up a lot in your 20s, but already in your teens, you were still in that cultural bubble in a very real way. You were put into an arranged marriage when you were, was it 16, 17 years old, to a 31-year-old Afghan doctor? Were you, as an American, Afghan-American teenager, what did you make of that?
I was first presented with the idea when I was 16, and at the time, I always thought that I wanted an arranged marriage. I didn't really sympathize with what I thought was this American teenager sort of attitude, which I thought was pretty shallow. I don't know, a lot of the young American teens, I thought, didn't really value the wisdom of their elders. There wasn't a sense of community in their lives. And so, and I saw a lot of value in the way that my community functioned and the values that my parents had. I saw that they had a successful arranged marriage, and I had seen others work around me. So it took, you know, it was a really difficult process to figure out what to do. But in the end, I decided to go for it, provided that I could go to college. And that was really my one condition.
Did you really have a choice, Masuda? Did your parents offer you a choice? We've arranged this. You don't, but just do it only if you want to do it. Was that the way it came?
I did have a choice. They brought it to me and they said, we want to know what you think. Mm-hmm. We want you to decide. Now, granted, when you're 16, you don't really have a good sense of what it is that you should do with your life. And I really, like just any young American teenager, wanted in many ways to also please my parents and please my family. Mm-hmm. So at that time, I thought that, you know, they know what's best. And I ultimately did agree with them. There was pressure because they really felt that this was a good person for me. I thought that this was a good person for me as well, given that, you know, there were a lot of similarities in culture. Mm-hmm. So he spoke the same language, you know, came from mm-hmm. the same place. And, you know, I started to think that, you know, perhaps they're onto something here. And I took my time, and that's what I decided.
You've worked a lot on women's issues since then. You got to know a lot about Afghan male-female interaction within that marriage. You ended up leaving it. Why?
Unfortunately, it was a very bad choice in the end. There were a lot of issues within the marriage. Some of it related to the difference of age. Some of it related to the fact that I still hadn't come into my own skin and mm-hmm. found that I was curious about a lot of things, including aspects of American life that my husband didn't encourage me or didn't want me to explore. I also did not want to start a family. I wanted to continue my education. At that point, I thought I wanted to go to law school. I had all these ideas of things that I wanted to do, which I thought that I could do with my husband, but in the end, couldn't do. And so and I hate this because it's kind of a stereotypical situation, but I was in a situation where I was with someone who didn't appreciate me, who didn't value my intelligence, and who ultimately didn't value me.
You went to Afghanistan. You found a lot of women living in constrained circumstances there.
I was that first trip to Afghanistan during Taliban times. It was July of 2001. I went back to really try to understand where it was we came from. And what I found changed me forever.
Masuda Sultan, please hold that thought. We'll come right back to it. We're speaking with Afghan-American memoirist Masuda Sultan. Shabnam is calling from Belmont, Massachusetts. Hi, Shabnam. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm just calling because I feel really disappointed by the lack of depth in covering this matter of the Afghan Christian.
How should we look at it? What should we know that we don't?
Well, I mean, maybe you hadn't planned for it because of the recent thing, but because it's not a question of just personal freedom versus lack of personal freedom. I mean, people over here have told me, oh well, people can convert here from Christianity to Islam, and they do that all the time. And yes, but there's a difference.
What is the difference?
The difference is that there is not a continuous onslaught on Christianity like there is on Islam by the West, and everywhere Islamic values, whatever is precious to Islam, whatever is dear to Islam, whatever is beautiful in Islam, is constantly being assaulted and mocked by the West, the Western media, whether it's left, right, center, NPR included.
Do you feel then Afghans in an apparent readiness to kill this man, are they trying to hold a line somehow culturally to protect tradition,
yes,
Shabnam?
There is this feeling. How would you feel if your country had 500,000 Afghan soldiers milling around, raiding villages, picking up young men off the streets, torturing them, killing them, shipping them off to Guantanamo Bay? Then, you know, I mean...
But we're told in Afghanistan that Americans were fairly welcome there, that the Taliban had outlived its welcome.
Well, you see, this is what we are told. But I know of people. This is there are Canadian Afghans that I'm in touch with who have mm-hmm. been to Afghanistan and who have said that like there is practically no village that has not been untouched. People are just the helicopter gunships or helicopters or whatever swoop down at night. They tie mm-hmm. up the people to pick up the young men, and there is and the, of course the drug problem has gotten like totally out of hand under the Americans. The Taliban has stopped it, and so the idea that Americans have here that everything is just perfect. Hafiz Karzai is the mayor of Kabul. That's all he is. He's a puppet. Nobody takes him seriously. Everybody knows what he is.
Shabnam, we hear your passion on this, and you're a reminder that there are two sides to every coin. Let us pick that up with Masuda Sultan. Masuda, in the most serious terms, this was brought home to you. Tell us first the story of your family in southern Afghanistan, what happened to them, and then how you put that into your understanding of the meeting of these two countries.
Well, shortly after the U.S. Bombing of Afghanistan happened, starting October 7th, I was in...
All the way back in 2001, yeah.
2001, mm-hmm. That's correct. I was still in New York and, of course, having just re-met a lot of this family or met for the first time a lot of this family in Kandahar, was worried about them. But at the same time, it was a very difficult time because at the same time, I also felt that the Taliban had such a strong grip on the country when I had visited that I didn't know how they were ever going to be defeated. Mm-hmm. And so on the one hand, I wanted U.S. intervention and I wanted the Taliban to be gone and al-Qaeda to be gone. On the other hand, I worried about how that would affect, how it would be carried out and how that would affect our family on the ground. And mm-hmm. so I ended up going to Pakistan, through Pakistan to Afghanistan to find my family and find out what changes were happening on the ground in December of 2001 with a film crew. Mm. And sadly, I in Pakistan, I met up with some of my family. And while the cameras were rolling, they described to me the horrifying attack on their village. Now, they had been in Kandahar City when the war broke out, and they planned to stay there, except it got really, really bad. They were living next to some Taliban-controlled buildings, mm-hmm. and so one night they just decided to flee, and they went to a village named Chokar outside of Kandahar, thinking that there they could be safe. And then one evening, very late at night, AC-130 gunships, bombs falling, rotating cannons shooting out at them. They describe this horrific scene.
These are American gunships and big ones. Mm-hmm.
Yes, little girls and boys telling me how they ran out of their the houses and in the dark, just any which way they could, trying to avoid being killed. And little girls told me of just seeing blood and gore and body parts, and it was just this unbelievably horrific scene. And they're telling me this, and I'm thinking, here I am as an American also listening to this. And I know, you know, at least I feel that our intention in Afghanistan was to liberate Afghans, that we care about Afghans. And somehow I'm in this very odd position of hearing them out and them asking me and the crew, why did they target us? Why did the Americans want to kill us?
Well, how did they become targeted, your cousins in Afghanistan?
Well, we still don't know. Lots of theories, including one that says, you know, that the United States was paying people on the ground to identify targets. And although my family had no vendetta with anyone, someone could have mistakenly targeted them. Some of them could have intentionally targeted them. They really don't know, and the military doesn't really offer answers. They just say, there were Taliban in the village, and everyone in the village, including my family, says there were no Taliban. We hate the Taliban. You know, they oppressed us.
So there it is, a price that your family paid in the middle of a rough war. Shabnam says you don't know how beleaguered Muslim countries feel, Afghanistan perhaps feels, under assault by Western culture. Those gunships were sent in part to be liberators. Here you are, Afghan-American. How do you look at this meeting? What's been won and what gets lost?
Well, you know, my family was really angry, as you can imagine. But what I was surprised at was how understanding they also could have been. I mean, they did say to me, we understand these things do happen in war, but, you know, why were we targeted? They were just so much in shock and so lost. And I began to realize that, you know, when mistakes happen, regardless of how you feel about the war, because, you know, there are people who think we should have never gone into Afghanistan. I know that those are in the minority in this country. There are people who feel very strongly that we should have gone into Afghanistan. We obviously didn't capture bin Laden or Mullah Omar. But I'll get beyond all of that. Mm-hmm. Forget about what your position is on the war. Mm-hmm. Here you are sitting in front of a family saying, you know, who has nothing at this point, who's lost 19 members. And they're saying, we want an explanation. We want an apology. Why did this happen to us? Where are the Americans? How are they going to help us now? We have children lying in the hospitals. We had to pick up the body parts off of the ground and put them on tractors to take them back into the city to bury them. Help us understand. And so I think when you're confronted with that, you know, the first questions to ask are, how did this happen? And I thought very naively that I would just go back to the United States. I would go to the military base in Kandahar Airport and just start asking questions, because I really believe that Americans in their hearts did not intend to hurt Afghan civilians. And so I thought it was very simple. I'd go get explanation, get them help.
And those were answers you did not ultimately get. We've got a very short time left, and I want to ask you to look ahead for us. I don't know how long American troops are going to be in Afghanistan, but this last week has raised everyone's perked up our ears a little bit here. Do you see these countries coming closer together over time in this close embrace, or do Americans need to get out?
You know, the question of America's presence in Afghanistan is again a complicated issue. I think most Afghans want some American presence because the country is still in a very fragile state and they really do want American support. They want more American support. They want commitment. They want to see change in their lives. Afghans don't hate Americans. Mm-hmm. I think most Americans don't understand that Afghans consider Americans their friends. But, you know, they get really frustrated when they feel like there's a lot of hypocrisy. There's all this talk of democracy. There's this talk of women's rights. But in their own lives, they're not seeing the change that they were told they would see. And so the expectations were high. And so we need to step up. And so if you're talking about these countries coming closer together, you know, I think there's a lot of potential for that. I think Afghanistan has a lot of I personally have a lot of hope for Afghanistan. It's very frustrating, but we have to be patient, and these things don't happen overnight. But they don't happen by themselves either. We have to take an active role in fulfilling the commitments that we made to those people.
Masuda Sultan, you're a clear voice and a compelling one. We haven't heard enough of you today. I hope you'll come back and talk with us some more, share your unique perspective with us. Thank you very much for the memoir, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Masuda Sultan, Afghan-American author of the new memoir, My War at Home. In a moment, the latest developments from Baghdad on the release of reporter Jill Carroll. This is On Point. There is very good news to report out of Baghdad. You've probably heard it. American hostage Jill Carroll has been released unharmed. The 28-year-old journalist was working for the Christian Science Monitor when she was kidnapped on January 7th in a bloody ambush. Her captors had threatened her death and demanded the release of all women detainees in Iraq. In an interview on Baghdad television today, Carroll said she didn't know why she was kidnapped, but she was treated well during the ordeal.
Very good treatment. I was kept in a very good, small, safe place, a safe room, nice furniture. They gave me clothing, plenty of food. I was allowed to take showers, go to the bathroom when I wanted.
Details of Carroll's release are still coming out. For the latest, we turn now to Borzu Dargahi, correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He knows Jill Carroll as a friend and colleague and joins us now from Baghdad. Borzu, thanks for being with us. There must be a sense of relief among the American press in Baghdad today.
Oh, absolutely. It's just like a huge weight has been lifted from our shoulders. We'd all been very, very worried. Just every day, and not a day went by when we didn't think about Jill Carroll and what happened to her, as well as her her translator, Alan Anwia, whom we also all knew, who was killed in the initial abduction attempt, and we shouldn't forget that.
Did you, in your heart of hearts, Borzu, think she was going to come out? Did you have any idea?
Well, I'd like to think that very few journalists have actually been murdered by insurgents in this conflict. So we definitely hope that she would be alive and make it out in good shape. And apparently she did, and she seemed in really good spirits. So, you know, definitely we hoped it. But in recent days, you had Tom Fox, who was an American peace activist who'd been abducted in November, and his body was found in Baghdad. So we were very worried that and very, very concerned that perhaps, she might not make it out alive.
Tremendous joy at the Christian Science Monitor today, the newspaper she was freelancing for. I want to hear a little bit of that from a press conference this morning at the paper's Boston headquarters. Editor Rick Bergenheim sharing his joy.
Today's just a wonderful day of rejoicing. Jill's friends at the Monitor can't wait to see her. And there's no way to thank everyone in the press, everyone around the world, all government officials, all Iraqi people. Our hearts go out to you and thanks.
Thanks all round there. Borzu, what, if anything, is known at this point about who kidnapped Jill, why, and why she was released?
You know, according to Jill herself, she's not sure why she was kidnapped, and she's not sure who kidnapped her or why she was released. There was a group that was called the Revenge Brigades, and they had claimed that they had her. This issue was proving to be a real embarrassment for a lot of the mainstream Sunni parties, the Sunni Arab parties. If listeners recall, Jill Carroll was going to meet a Sunni Arab politician when she was kidnapped, and this matter was really embarrassing those politicians. And so you saw what you did see, which was the Iraqi Islamic Party, the main Sunni Arab party, was the one who received her when she was freed. And they kind of made a publicity stunt out of her release. They had her on TV talking, and they also showered her with gifts in the TV coverage.
We want to think about what pressure was brought to bear here and whether or not it worked. Here was Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice speaking today with this reaction to Jill Carroll's release.
This is something that people have across the world worked for and prayed for, and I think we're all very pleased and happy to hear of her release.
Borzu, there in Baghdad, what's your sense of the impact that pressure and pleas had here? Is that what worked? Are there pressure points that were worked here? Is that possible?
I mean, there's a few different possibilities. And one is that the insurgents that were holding Jill Carroll decided that it was harming their cause more than it was helping, this abduction and this continued kidnapping of Jill Carroll. And, you know, I mean, we shouldn't discount the possibility, and I have no information about that, but in the past, there's been, when there has been these release of hostages, there have been stories of money surreptitiously changing hands. Often that's what the insurgents want. Maybe there was some other deal that took place. Not sure at all. It's all sort of in the speculative phase at this point.
There were some women released along the way. Was it all female prisoners in Iraq, as the kidnappers demanded, or not?
I'm not sure if all female prisoners were released. My sense is that whole female prisoners being released thing is almost always sort of a code word for some other demands that they're making. Not sure what it meant.
And with her kidnap and now release, has it changed the way American journalists are working in Baghdad? Will it change it? Has it changed it one way or another?
I think the things here are you know, so dire in some ways that many journalists don't go out. I'm kind of fortunate. I have a very low profile here because I'm of Middle East descent myself. So I go out a lot, and I do maybe a lot of things that other journalists are not able to do because they're not print and they're not low profile enough. But, you know, things have gotten so perilous here in terms of the various tragedies and types of violence that could befall someone, that people here are extremely cautious and extremely careful.
Borzu Dargahi, correspondent for the Los Angeles Times in Baghdad, we're very thankful that your friend and colleague Jill Carroll is released today. Thanks very much for giving us the latest.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.